I'd like to invite up our next speaker, Dr. Joshua Wolf. He is from Sinai Hospital in Baltimore, and he is going to be talking to us on fissures. They are no laughing matter.
Thanks very much for the opportunity to talk about this topic. As already pointed out, please no laughing allowed during this presentation. No laughing matter. I have no disclosures. So I wanted to start with a case presentation. In the office, 35-year-old man presents with sharp anal pain and bleeding per rectum. Symptoms initially followed an episode of straining and persisted for many weeks. The patient's unable to tolerate a full exam. Well, on partial exam, you can appreciate there's a break in the anal mucosa, suspicious for an anal fissure. So we can all recognize that's a classic presentation. Patients will often complain this is the worst sensation they've ever had down there, feel like a piece of glass, and that's because there's a longitudinal tear in the distal anal canal. It's a very common office complaint. How common has not really been studied well by epidemiologists. It's difficult to capture the true incidence or prevalence because of all the significant overlap with other anorectal complaints. Proper management, like any condition, requires accurate characterization and classification. What I mean by that is really two questions up front must be answered. First, is it a typical or atypical fissure? And this gets at the underlying etiology for a typical fissure, the belief pathophysiology stems from hypertrophy and hypertonicity of the distal anal canal with resultant decreased blood flow in the midline based on the anatomy. Those are watershed areas, anterior and posterior, that are subjected to local ischemia. Atypical features, which I'll show in just another slide, should warrant a different workup entirely. But if assuming it's a typical fissure, the next question to ask is it acute or chronic? Because that will guide the immediate next step in management. There's no real consensus in the literature on when a typical fissure should be considered chronic. Generally speaking, it's about 6 weeks. So you can all appreciate that the image on the left is a typical anal fissure. It's in the midline, more or less, and has indurated edges. And you can even make out some hypertrophy at the internal apex, all classic signs. And the image on the right is very different, obviously, irregular, some very concerning discoloration. And some extension laterally. I show this because it comes from a case series of anal carcinoma misdiagnosed as idiopathic chronic anal fissure, which is every surgeon's nightmare, of course. So how to pick up on the atypical fissure before it progresses to an extreme presentation such as that picture I just showed? Typical features, as I mentioned, in the midline. So location will be either posterior or anterior, more commonly posterior, and classic symptoms like the vignette I described with hypertonicity of the anal sphincter. Atypical features, laterality, multiplicity, and inconsistent symptoms, even in a classic location, if it's not characterized with the same pain, that should warrant some suspicion for an atypical fissure. And a lack of hypertonicity, so normal anal tone or hypotonicity of the anal sphincter should warrant some suspicion as well. A otherwise classic fissure with hypotonic anal tone is described in postpartum patients and very poorly understood in that context. So here's a differential diagnosis for atypical anal fissure. Malignancy, obviously, as already mentioned, anal cancer or just dysplasia, melanoma or even adenocarcinoma and Paget's disease, IBD, Crohn's in particular, with up to 30% of patients having perianal manifestations, various STDs, in particular syphilis, and of course HIV, which can have its own anal ulcer presentation, especially in advanced AIDS. And then infectious non-STD infections, such as TB or fungal infections, and of course trauma, either self-inflicted or assault. If you like mnemonics, I'll give you one, which is don't miss it. And this is how I remember, because I don't want to miss it. Each of these obviously requires somewhat urgent workup and treatment. But let's say it's a typical fissure. The next question, as I mentioned, is the duration of symptoms. And if it's ever unclear on history, you can look to the physical exam. A simple tear would indicate acute, as opposed to signs of chronic change, like a sentinel pile, which is an external skin tag at the external apex, or hypertrophied anal papilla at the internal apex, and raised edges on the border. Here are pictures depicting those changes. On the left, a simple tear. On the right, obviously more progressed lesion with hypertrophy on both sides of the fissure itself. Acute fissures are initially managed just with improved bowel function, fiber water, sitz baths for symptomatic relief, and 50%, I'll make this more glass half full, so 50% will improve with that management, and of the 50% that fail, they require management of chronic anal fissure, which really mandates reducing the sphincter tone. That can be done a number of ways. So that it can be done first and foremost with topical medication, which has no risk of long-term incontinence but has a 50% failure rate. It can be done with chemo denervation of the internal sphincter with botulinum toxin injection. And it can be done surgically with lateral internal sphincterotomy, which is the surgery of choice according to ASCRS guidelines that I'll show in just a moment, as opposed to older procedures such as posterior internal sphincterotomy, which can lead to a keyhole defect, or uncontrolled dilatation of the sphincter, which was kind of an ancient procedure. For patients that are not candidates for sphincter division because of either prior obstetric injury or any baseline deficit incontinence, anocutaneous flap plus or minus fissurectomy can be considered. Here are the guidelines. Came out last year, practice guideline for the management of anal fissures. So with respect to topical sphincter relaxation, nitrates and calcium channel blockers both have level 1A evidence, randomized data against placebo and against each other with about 50-50 efficacy. Generally speaking, diltiazem or nifedipine will have a much lower rate of side effect compared to nitrates and therefore is preferred. Chemo denervation with botulinum toxin can be a next step or can be given as first line. Very variable results, perhaps due to heterogeneous protocols for dosing preparation and the injection site. It's described as being given in the intersphincteric space or into the muscle directly, and therefore there are a very wide range of efficacies reported, from 17 to 70% healing. But there's no long-term risk of incontinence with botulinum toxin injection. As I mentioned, the surgery of choice, lateral internal sphincterotomy, it can be selectively used as a first-line therapy, has an excellent efficacy, up to 100% in some series and usually above 90. Now, the incontinence rates following LIS, again, very variable. In the 80s and 90s, there were some large retrospective series that reported rates as high as 30%. Some of this is due to differences in how incontinence is defined, including minor incontinence. And there's also somewhat of a selection bias in that the randomized controlled data tends to have a much lower rate of incontinence, and this is probably due to the fact that there are strict inclusion criterion in randomized trials for performing an LAS as opposed to retrospective cohort data. Two variants of the lateral internal sphincterotomy have been described. Open, of course, is where you would directly visualize the muscle that's being divided through a mucosal incision. Closed is the insertion of an 11 blade into the intersphincteric space with the vision of the hypertrophied muscle onto a finger inserted internally, hopefully not through into the finger. These two techniques have been compared head-to-head in randomized trials, and there's absolutely no difference in efficacy or incontinence rates. The other controversy that comes up is how much muscle should really be divided. Again, after the higher rates of incontinence were reported in the 90s, a modified procedure was proposed. The traditional procedure involves division of the muscle up to the level of the dentate line. Little John proposed a tailored approach that divides muscle up to the internal apex of the fissure itself. These have been compared in three randomized controlled trials, two of which showed higher rates of recurrence in the tailored approach with lower rates of incontinence, but we're really talking about low rates of both recurrence and incontinence. Recurrence rates somewhere between 10 and 13%, and incontinence less than 1 to 5%. And again, that includes minor incontinence, the follow-up on these studies, 1 to 2 years. So lastly, an alternative option for patients who are really not candidates for a sphincter division is an anocutaneous flap. There is really not any randomized data at this point. It's all retrospective, but generally speaking, inferior healing, as would be expected, but lower rates of incontinence because no sphincter has been divided. But this is a good option in patients who really shouldn't have any surgical sphincter division. Other options that are out there but don't have, but are really at this point more experimental, controlled pneumatic dilatation has been described. That is sort of a follow-up procedure from the uncontrolled manual dilatation, and results were reported in comparison to lateral internal sphincterotomy as similar, but it's a single group and really a single set of studies. And more recently, autologous-derived adipose stem cell injection, which, as you heard, is being used for various anorectal complaints. This came out last year and may show some promise, so we'll look forward to seeing more about that in the future. So some principles and conclusions. It's important to differentiate typical from atypical features. Don't miss it. Initial therapy will be determined by fissure duration and baseline sphincter function. You can consider a stepwise approach for sphincter relaxation, but in certain patients with good selection, you can offer a lateral internal sphincterotomy up front and utilize alternative methods for patients who are not candidates for sphincterotomy. Thank you very much.